Chapter 7. In its self-ordained mission to coordinate the war on AIDS, the CDC used its full resources to popularize AIDS as a single infectious and terrifying plague. But the agency hardly succeeded in monopolizing interest in the epidemic. Other doctors also took notice of the rising numbers of young homosexual men dying of infections and conditions uncommon for their age group. From the time the CDC advertised its first AIDS cases, the apparently new syndrome invited speculation on its cause. Those medical professionals who followed the CDC's lead searched for an infectious agent. Michael Gottlieb, the first doctor to report AIDS cases, led a number of virus hunters in suggesting cytomegalovirus. Other well-known viruses, including Epstein-Barr, received growing attention. The retrovirus hunters found themselves torn between Gallo's HTLV-1 and the search for a new virus. Still, other researchers began thinking of bacteria or even new combinations of several old microbes together, all causing AIDS. The search for the cause of AIDS officially ended with Gallo's 1984 press conference. No American scientist had yet published a single paper on HIV, but most scientists understood the politics and quickly fell into line. Doubts about this virus were relegated to quiet conversations, especially among those researchers whose careers most directly depended on the NIH-CDC medical establishment. Most physicians never even heard any reason to question the official doctrine. For a few people, however, the press conference settled nothing. Doctors who knew something about the methods of scientific research and who felt a bit more independent of the federal government continued to raise questions. To them, the rush to blame HIV for such a complex and varied syndrome, one that struck people with so many obvious health risk factors, seemed simple-minded. By throwing its weight behind HIV, the AIDS establishment unwittingly spurred some of the alternative thinking it sought to end. The early days. Joseph Sonnabend became one of the first to break ranks. Having received a medical degree in his native South Africa, he found his way into basic research upon moving to Great Britain in the late 1950s. There he joined the revived microbe-hunting trend, albeit more from the angle of medical treatment, and began studying the body's immune response against viruses. He focused on interferon, a newly discovered protein that seemed to slow virus infections. Scientists have always placed great hopes in this substance, expecting it to serve as their long-sought magic bullet against viruses and cancer. Both of these dreams have died, but scientists are now trying to revive it for use against multiple sclerosis. The 1970s brought Sonnabend a temporary chance to conduct his research on interferon and viruses at a medical school in New York. After the money ran out, he practiced medicine at a public hospital in Brooklyn. He supplemented his income by working for the city's Department of Health, where in 1978 he briefly became director of the Venereal Diseases Division. In this capacity, he encountered many of the fast-track homosexuals who constantly needed treatment for their recurring diseases. Later that year, Sonnabend lost both positions. Although he preferred laboratory microbiology, he had little choice but to continue medicine. As a compromise, he decided to continue working on infectious diseases by starting his own private practice in Greenwich Village, New York, treating homosexual men for their venereal diseases. By the early 1980s, Sonnabend began seeing AIDS cases, just as similar patients were showing up at the UCLA Medical Center on the opposite coast. He recognized the descriptions in Gottlieb's 1981 report of five such men and immediately conducted research to find the cause. Having seen rising frequencies of venereal disease among homosexual men for years, Sonnabend instinctively reached for the most familiar explanation, that somehow the combination of all these conventional microbial infections caused immune suppression and AIDS. He went public with his hypothesis by 1982, publishing reports that men with immune deficiencies also had long histories of venereal disease, hepatitis, and even infections by obscure parasites. Meanwhile, he started treating his AIDS cases by using antibiotics and other medications directed against the opportunistic infections themselves, including Pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. But his views attracted little attention until a publisher suddenly provided Sonnabend the funding to create a scientific journal of his own. AIDS research was thus launched, and the first 12 pages of the first issue, published in 1983, contained a review written by Sonnabend himself entitled The Etiology of AIDS. The article officially proposed what he called the multifactorial model of causation. According to this notion, many different infections could have a combined effect that eventually destroys the immune system. He also hypothesized that semen itself, coming in contact with blood when erectile tissues were torn during anal intercourse, might cause immune suppression. Sonnabend opened his review by attacking the CDC viewpoint that AIDS was caused by some new virus, pointing out that no such virus had yet been isolated. Then he turned to his own idea. The first issue of this new journal is an appropriate occasion to review an alternative hypothesis regarding the genesis of AIDS. This hypothesis proposes that there is no specific etiologic agent of AIDS and suggests that the disease arises as a result of cumulative process following a period of exposure to multiple environmental factors. Among homosexual men, it appears that the disease has been occurring in a rather small subset characterized by having had sexual contact with large numbers of different partners. Such conditions were met in New York City, San Francisco, and Los Angeles in the 1970s as a result of changes in lifestyle that became apparent in the late 1960s. The specific factors we propose that interact to produce the disease in homosexual men are 1. Immune responses to semen, 2. Repeated infections with cytomegalovirus, CMV, 3. Episodes of reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus, EBV, and G. Infection with sexually transmitted pathogens, particularly those associated with immune complex formation, such as hepatitis B and syphilis. In explaining AIDS in Haiti or Africa, Sonnabend argued their diseases might not be new at all and could reflect such factors as poverty and malnutrition, some tropical infections, while in the case of blood transfusion recipients, it is well known that blood transfusions are themselves immunosuppressive. In any case, he criticized the CDC assumption of a new AIDS virus in no uncertain terms, specifically taking on their cluster study as not being proof AIDS was a single infectious disease. That AIDS results from infection with a specific etiologic agent remains a hypothesis. An alternative explanation is that the cases occurred in a relatively small subset of homosexual men who shared a similar lifestyle. Sonnabend accurately dismantled the assumptions of the virus-hunting establishment, exposing the lack of evidence for AIDS as a single contagious disease. But his multifactorial hypothesis completely ignored the drug abuse factor in most AIDS patients. Those homosexuals at greatest risk for the syndrome, who had long records of infectious disease, also had used enormous quantities of recreational drugs, especially the alkyl nitrates. Sonnabend tended to overlook drugs as a risk factor largely because of his virology background and his experience treating venereal diseases. He forgot that infectious diseases do not affect everyone equally. Probably no germ on earth, from the most common flu virus to the deadly cholera bacterium, causes disease in every infected individual. Only those people whose resistance is lowered for some reason, even a temporary immune deficiency from lack of sleep or other causes, become ill. A healthy person's immune system efficiently suppresses microbes and prevents symptoms, regardless of the number of infections. Multiple contagious diseases, therefore, could not cause immune suppression in a person, but must rather be the result of immune deficiencies for other reasons. Even semen, particularly in the minute quantities that could contact blood in anal intercourse, could not have an irreversible effect on the immune system. Sonnabend continued making his argument. Soon after launching AIDS research, he published a similar review paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association, co-authored with his colleagues and close collaborators, Stephen Witkin and David Pertillo. As he stepped up the debate, Sonnabend found himself increasingly crossing paths with Robert Gallo. To counter Gallo's early hypothesis that HTLV-1 was the AIDS virus, Sonnabend tested 70 patients and reported that none of them had antibodies against the virus. He shortly thereafter published a letter to the editor of Nature in 1984, following Gallo's press conference announcing HTLV-3 as the cause, stating that since HTLV-1, 2, and now 3 could each be isolated from some AIDS patients, this suggests that they are more likely to represent opportunistic infections or reactivations from latency. He made the same point in a 1985 letter published in the Wall Street Journal, suggesting that HIV might only be a harmless, opportunistic virus found in some people after their immune systems had already been destroyed. He also acknowledged the possible role of drugs in the causation of AIDS, an unusual departure from his multifactorial hypothesis. As late as 1988, while he was working on a chapter for a medical textbook, Sonnabend wrote to Peter Duisberg, describing the effects of growing political pressure to swallow the HIV hypothesis. "I just spoke to David Pertillo, who does not wish to be on the update unless a role for HIV can be put in. Stephen Witkin also wants a role for HIV, so I'll do it alone." By the time the textbook finally appeared, Sonnabend's longtime collaborators had removed their names. His prestige had been such that James Curran, head of the CDC's KSOI task force, which scoured for evidence to prove AIDS an infectious disease, personally consulted with Sonnabend in 1981. Sonnabend takes credit for devising the notion of safe sex, the use of condoms, supposedly to prevent transmission of AIDS or the venereal diseases he believes cause it, which has become popular with public health authorities as a fetish of AIDS prevention. When a press conference was organized in February of 1985 to announce that Gallo's isolate of HIV was suspiciously identical to that of Montagnier, Sonnabend was the man chosen to make the presentation. The FDA used Sonnabend's unorthodox clinical trial. He had dispensed with the time-honored testing rules of double-blind controls and placebos to approve the aerosolized drug pentamidine for treatment of pneumocystis pneumonia and to set precedent for future licensing. His most powerful connection has been Matilda Krim, a colleague who has also studied interferon's effects on virus infection. Krim was more than just another scientist. Her husband, a Hollywood veteran who founded Orion Pictures, had also been chairman in charge of finances for the National Democratic Party, and therefore a consultant to several presidents. Krim herself had been one of the powerful individuals selected for the Senate's panel of consultants in 1970, which advised Richard Nixon to launch the war on cancer. Krim had long befriended Sonnabend, and when he began running out of money to continue his AIDS research in 1982, she stepped in. She organized the American Medical Foundation, AMF, to finance his work, and her clout brought onto the board several important scientists, as well as former President Jimmy Carter's wife, Rosalind. So much money flowed into the foundation that other scientists offered to collaborate with Sonnabend in order to benefit. Although Sonnabend sometimes enjoyed forays into unfashionable areas of medical research, he clearly stood to lose much by straying too far from the official line. By continuing to question the HIV hypothesis, he unwittingly did precisely that. In 1985, 1 year after Gallo's press conference, the axe began to fall. The publisher who had financed his journal, AIDS Research, suddenly replaced Sonnabend with Danny Bolognese, a retrovirologist at Duke University. Bolognese was one of Gallo's closest allies, a member of the informal Bob Club, and therefore a partisan for the HIV hypothesis. As the new editor, Bolognese dumped Sonnabend and his supporters, bringing on board his own retrovirus-hunting friends, Max Essex and Robert Gallo. The journal's new title became AIDS Research and Human Retroviruses, and thereafter it published only papers founded on the HIV hypothesis. Its days of open inquiry were over. Meanwhile, Matilda Krim was reorganizing the AMF, negotiating a merger with a more glamorous and better-funded foundation under Michael Gottlieb, the scientist who reported the first five AIDS cases. Gottlieb objected to any doubts about HIV, and Krim ejected Sonnabend from the foundation and its support. Sonnabend found himself isolated, having learned a bitter lesson about challenging a view so cherished by the medical powers that be. At this point, Krim stepped in again, playing good cop to Gottlieb's bad cop. She helped Sonnabend establish a new organization for sponsoring research on AIDS treatments, the Community Research Initiative. After more than a year of setup, the group began receiving funds. Sonnabend's criticisms of the HIV hypothesis gradually became muted or were relegated to obscure newsletters. By 1989, he had so sufficiently won his way back into good graces that Krim arranged a public meeting at Columbia University with NIH officials. At the luncheon table, Sonnabend was seated between Sam Broder, Gallo's boss and head of the National Cancer Institute, and Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Both were power brokers of the AIDS establishment to whom Sonnabend had finally become acceptable. The sanctions have taken their toll. In 1992, when an interviewer asked, "What if HIV doesn't cause the disease?" Sonnabend responded, "Well, I have reluctance in speaking about this too, because I am a great believer that safer sexual practices are important and that needle sharing is not a good idea." He continued to evade the interviewer's questions about Peter Duisberg, finally declaring bluntly, "There are good reasons why HIV is a respectable candidate. For Duisberg to say that HIV cannot be the cause would mean that he wouldn't want any research to be done on HIV, and that's kind of ridiculous too. I'll go to great lengths to make sure that I am not confused with Peter Duisberg." Indeed he does. He joined Duisberg and other dissidents at a May 1992 meeting of HIV critics in Amsterdam, Holland. On the final day of the conference, Sonnabend stunned the participants by issuing a press release attacking Duisberg on official symposium stationery. The man who once argued AIDS was not infectious now lashed out at Duisberg for saying the same thing and insisted that his outrageous assertion that safe sex is irrelevant to the spread of AIDS is appalling and may kill people. He even managed to get a few participants to co-sign the release. But AIDS dissident John Lauritsen rallied most of the others at the meeting to Duisberg's defense, issuing their own contrary press release. Some of Sonnabend's co-signers switched sides or publicly apologized. Sonnabend himself was seen by witnesses privately apologizing to Duisberg, although he officially denied it later in print. His public attack may have primarily resulted from worries about attending the meeting in the first place. Even Sonnabend's private medical practice has been changed. Originally, he had been widely known for his vocal opposition to the toxic chemotherapy AZT as AIDS treatment. A 1988 article quoted him as declaring, "AZT is incompatible with life," and he refused to prescribe the drug to his own AIDS patients. But he now admits to giving his patients AZT when they requested it and no longer lobbies against it. He has shifted course sufficiently that his old nemesis Robert Gallo invited him in 1993 to speak at the NIH. Sonnabend accepted, and his talk on interferon was well received by the believers in HIV. But of his old friend Duisberg, Sonnabend could only comment to an interviewer that, "On balance, I think Duisberg has been bad for the debate over the virus AIDS hypothesis." In a letter to Science on January 13, 1995, Sonnabend settles in the middle ground. "I may not be supportive of Peter Duisberg's arguments and dogmatism in rejecting HIV as the cause of AIDS, but John Cohen, in citing my criticism, did not make it clear that I continue to believe the issue of AIDS causation still remains open." His research group has been reorganized as the New York-based Community Research Initiative on AIDS, CRIA, where he conducts research on AIDS treatments and maintains a relatively low profile on the HIV controversy. At the same time that Sonnabend was first struggling against the growing AIDS virus hunt, another rebel was emerging nearby in New York City, John Lauritsen. Several years later, he would be described as one of the heroes of the epidemic by another medical dissident against HIV. He is not only a top-notch investigative reporter, in his own way, he is also a scientist. Lauritsen has worked in the survey research field since the mid-1960s, where he performed tasks as a market research executive and analyst. "Professional survey research," he explains, "maintains much higher professional standards than does its academic sister, epidemiology. Questionnaires require careful designing. Data must be rigorously checked after they are gathered. Tables must show all data clearly and completely, and statistics are analyzed critically." He had also co-authored The Early Homosexual Rights Movement, 1864 to 1935, and edited an anthology of writings by John Addington Symonds. Lauritsen, the scientist, and Lauritsen, the journalist, were both products of an A.B. degree from Harvard's Department of Social Relations. He first got involved in AIDS after he learned of Sonnabend's work. His attention was focused on the syndrome in 1983 when he decided to spend a week in the library of the New York Academy of Medicine reviewing for himself the still-small scientific literature on AIDS. The evidence quickly fell into place, strongly suggesting that AIDS was not an infectious disease. Lauritsen now suspected that some lifestyle environmental factor was killing people, not a microbe. Shortly thereafter, he stumbled across an article describing Hank Wilson, a well-known homosexual rights activist in San Francisco. Wilson was waging a one-man crusade against the use of poppers, the nitrate compounds inhaled almost entirely by fast-track male homosexuals as bathhouse aphrodisiacs and muscle relaxants. The volatile drugs made anal intercourse easier by relaxing the anal sphincter, but also had toxic effects on the blood and other parts of the body. Wilson had taken up this cause after friends who used poppers heavily began suffering swollen lymph nodes, which had led him to research the chemical nature of the nitrates. He found the Committee to Monitor Poppers in 1981, warning homosexuals of the dangers and lobbying for legal bans on the substance. Lauritsen began corresponding with Wilson and soon concluded that poppers and other recreational drugs being used in the bathhouses played some role in AIDS and other sickness. As a member of the New York Safe Sex Committee, Lauritsen began circulating warnings about poppers, prompting the group to include the following ending in a 1984 brochure. Avoid drugs. Shooting up kills. Uppers and downers put a real strain on your system. Pot and alcohol confuse your judgment. Poppers are also dangerous. But the advice fell on deaf ears. No one wanted to give up the popular drug. He then turned to Wilson, and the two of them began organizing a small but nationwide educational campaign that helped push Congress into outlawing poppers a few years later. By February of 1985, Lauritsen was able to publish his first article on AIDS, exposing the CDC's statistical tricks in hiding the association between poppers and the syndrome. As the CDC had been doing since the first reported AIDS cases, part of its campaign to paint AIDS as infectious. The piece appeared in the Philadelphia Gay News. As he soon discovered, the widespread hostility to his message meant that he could publish only in the homosexual press, and then only in a small subset of that. Lauritsen found a journalistic niche, freelancing for the New York Native, the largest independent homosexual interest weekly in the country. Independent it certainly was. Its publisher and editor, Charles Ortlieb, had infuriated the CDC and other public health and medical officials when he began questioning the official theory that HIV is the cause of AIDS. Ortlieb knew he would not believe the HIV hypothesis when he published Lauritsen's critique on the research that had led to the approval of AZT as a treatment for AIDS in record time. Lauritsen also wrote in The Native about his own drug AIDS hypothesis alongside the unfolding story of the HIV debate. By including complete bibliographies, Lauritsen's articles first introduced scientific documentation to science reporting in the non-professional literature. In 1987, The Native first introduced Duesberg to the gay community with a Lauritsen interview on October 5, 1992. The paper even put Duesberg on its cover. Over the furious objections of ACT-UP officials from New York, the cover called Duesberg an international hero because Peter Duesberg bravely speaks truth to power in his battle against AZT and HIV apartheid. In 1988, Ortlieb added his own AIDS hypothesis to the list of HIV challenges, postulating that AIDS is caused by human herpes virus 6. Together with staff reporter Ninja Ostrom, he had made this hypothesis the focus of the journal's investigations on the cause of AIDS. By 1986, Lauritsen had left full-time survey research to allow himself to focus on AIDS. That year, he and Hank Wilson produced a small self-published book, Death Rush, Poppers and AIDS. In it, he made his complete case for the role of poppers and other drugs in causing AIDS, impressively documented with dozens of scientific papers on the subject. He also thoroughly exposed the conflicting interests of homosexual publications and academia in their ties to the poppers industry. He included two pages citing Koch's postulates to argue against HIV as the cause of AIDS. His articles continued to reflect his own research. In March of 1987, for example, he wrote a devastating attack on a National Academy of Sciences report, pointing to their own admission that HIV is neutralized by antibodies as evidence against the virus hypothesis. But 2 months after his article was published, he read Duesberg's original cancer research article. To Lauritsen, it was a stunning confirmation of everything he had suspected. In his own words, "I had never heard of such concepts as biomedical activity, and it clicked. I no longer had any doubt that HIV was not the cause." Lauritsen was referring to Duesberg's argument that a dormant biochemically inactive virus like HIV could not cause any disease, let alone the many fatal AIDS diseases. The following June, an article by Charles Ortlieb appeared in The Native, excitedly reviewing Duisberg's paper. Ortlieb tracked down Duisberg, finding him near the end of his stint at the NIH. Lauritsen immediately caught a train to Bethesda, becoming the first journalist to interview Duisberg. In preparing for the interview, Lauritsen had phoned the CDC and NIH to pester officials with questions about HIV. Confronting the National Cancer Institute's press officer, he pressed for the definitive proof that the virus caused AIDS. She was unable to answer and deferred until the following day, returning the call to read off a hastily prepared response. Nothing she said directly answered Duisberg's arguments, so Lauritsen raised the obvious issue of Koch's postulates. Her reply serves as the perfect picture of modern virus hunting. "What are those? I've never heard of them. How do you spell that? Koch? What did you say? Koch? When were those made?" Lauritsen, "About a century ago." "Oh, well then, would you say that those apply now?" The approval of AZT as AIDS therapy pushed Lauritsen to take on a new fight. He read the evidence and concluded that such a toxic chemotherapy could do nothing but worsen an AIDS condition, since the drug destroyed the immune system. His investigation led him through a maze of sloppy scientific papers, the federal bureaucracy in trying to release documents under the Freedom of Information Act, and uncooperative researchers. A critical letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, which had published the original AZT trials in humans, yielded Lauritsen nothing but a private response that dodged his facts and airily declared, "I don't know of any noteworthy clinical investigator in the AIDS field who takes your position." Fed up with the closed doors and arrogance of the establishment, Lauritsen wrote several articles on AZT for The Native and compiled his information into another book, Poison by Prescription: The AZT Story, self-published in 1990. The book remains the most comprehensive critique of AZT available today. In 1993, Lauritsen self-published another book, The AIDS War: Propaganda, Profiteering, and Genocide from the Medical Industrial Complex. The angry tone reflects his years of struggle. A mix of new material and previously published articles, its 480 pages cover topics ranging from AZT to the death of ballet superstar Rudolf Nureyev, from AZT and AIDS. Most of Lauritsen's first interview with Duisberg is printed, along with exposures of the cozy relationships between AIDS organizations and the pharmaceutical industry. Portions even discuss a program of recovery from AIDS, focusing on the health risks Lauritsen implicates in causing the syndrome. Mostly, the book is a personal story documenting the fight against HIV as seen by someone on the front lines. Other alternative views. In the wake of challenges against the HIV hypothesis by Sonnabend, Lauritsen, and Duisberg, other medical doctors and scientists gradually began joining the chorus of opposition. Some were encouraged to find their open doubts shared by prestigious figures. Others had previously felt intimidated in speaking out alone, and a few simply had never given thought to possibilities other than HIV. Not all of these people volunteered their own alternative hypotheses, but all were united in questioning the HIV monopoly in AIDS research and treatment. For those who did propose alternative causes, the temptation lay in imitating Sonnabend's multifactorial model. AIDS patients not only carried a multitude of opportunistic diseases, but also engaged in extremely promiscuous sexual activity or needle sharing, behaviors that gave the patients long histories of venereal and parasitic infections. Thus, a researcher could easily blame any of those microbes for AIDS purely on the basis of a heavy overlap between almost any germ and the syndrome. Some, like Sonnabend, chose to blame many or all of the microbes simultaneously, creating a cumbersome and largely untestable notion of AIDS as the consequence of some undefinable combination of diverse germs. Others preferred to implicate one or two specific microbes, sometimes as cofactors with HIV. According to this view, AIDS was still a truly contagious disease for which the wrong microbe had been identified. For a few years, syphilis became the most popular alternative hypothesis. Some superficial associations made this idea seem plausible. The syphilis bacterium, for one thing, had the old reputation as the great masquerader, supposedly being able to imitate symptoms of diverse and unrelated diseases. Neurosyphilis, brain rot, had achieved legendary proportions in this regard and seemed to parallel the symptoms of AIDS dementia. The standard test for syphilis infection, moreover, turned out to be less reliable than previously thought, generating false negative results in people who had been infected. Improved testing revealed high percentages of AIDS patients with prior syphilis, and AIDS education had taught everybody that AIDS, just like syphilis, was a sexually transmitted disease. On the other hand, a hard look at AIDS quickly dispels any connection between the two. Neurosyphilis, as we heard previously, most probably never had anything to do with syphilis bacillus. It never appeared during the original syphilis infection, instead manifesting only after the common treatments of the day, mercury, antimony, and arsenic. Mozart is said to have been one person so treated until his early death. Poisoning has often been blamed for late-stage syphilis symptoms, including the many conditions that earn syphilis its image as a masquerader. Indeed, carefully monitored, syphilitics have proven to have normal lifespans in the absence of toxic treatment. Exotic symptoms aside, syphilis behaves no differently from any other microbe in that disease itself results from, not causes immune deficiency. As we have noted, healthy immune systems easily suppress any microbe and prevent sickness. Even the syphilis bacterium can do little damage in an otherwise healthy person. For thousands of years before the age of antibiotics, most people survived syphilis without lasting consequences and without any treatment. This microbe further has no latent period between infection and disease, which contrasts the years required for AIDS to develop. Finally, AIDS is not a contagious disease, as evidenced by its tight restriction to risk groups. Another bacterial hypothesis of AIDS was evolving at the same time the syphilis proposal was gathering supporters. In 1986, a virologist named Shi Qing Lo first reported finding a new virus in several AIDS patients. He performed some of these experiments at the National Cancer Institute, where colleagues scoffed. In a noble attempt to meet Koch's postulates for causing AIDS, Lo went on to grow the virus in cultured cells and then infected 4 monkeys, all of which died of a wasting disease within months. But at that point, he ran into trouble. Lo had a tough time getting his findings published. "I forget how many journals turned us down," he says. One colleague put the figure at more than 6. Lo had some protection from other virus hunters because he worked at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, a military research facility entirely independent of the NIH-funded establishment. Nevertheless, he could not publish his results until 1989, and then only in a relatively obscure journal. By that time, he had further identified the nature of his virus, discovering he had actually been working with a mycoplasma, a tiny bacterium that prefers to hide inside cells. He named his finding Mycoplasma incognitus, reflecting the fact he had originally confused it with being a virus. Lo finally began receiving applause for his discovery the following year, once it was endorsed by Luc Montagnier, the French discoverer of HIV. Although Lo tested his mycoplasma using Koch's postulates, his microbe-hunting enthusiasm overran his scientific sense. The mycoplasma had in reality failed the test. He could not find the bacterium in many AIDS patients, thereby falling short of the first postulate. And the infected monkeys, while wasting away and dying, developed nothing like the wide spectrum of AIDS diseases, nor did their conditions have a latent period. Thus, the third postulate also eliminated the mycoplasma as a candidate. Mycoplasmas have been textbook subjects for decades. They cause roughly 1/3 of all human pneumonias and frequently contaminate the cell cultures of unsuspecting researchers. Unlike viral pneumonias, the mycoplasma pneumonias can be treated with tetracycline and other antibiotics. Mostly, these microbes function as opportunists, preying on people with weakened health. And since AIDS, as this audiobook presents, is not infectious at all, it could not be caused by this mycoplasma or any other microbe. The failure of tetracycline to cure AIDS drove the last nail into the coffin of the mycoplasma hypothesis. With regard to Gallo and the HIV dogma of AIDS, Lo did have poignant comments. In a letter to Policy Review in 1990, he and his supervisor wrote that, "To commit oneself exclusively to a particular agent and completely rule out any other possible role of a different microbe may result in a greater loss of AIDS victims."